And that is the only Polish name I'm going to say, because they're all enormous, 26 letters long, all the people.
I'm still hung up on famous gynecologists. Could you go more in depth on that?
Hello again, and welcome to another Zoomed edition of Talking Pictures. I'm Mary Stack.
And I'm Michael Dow.
And we are pleased to bring you a motley mixture of visual treats for your viewing and consideration. Between us this week, Mike and I are going to discuss three films, three series, and just a mention of a couple of docs. And I actually watched two foreign films this week and one Brit film. And they were both historical biopics, very starkly different. And then one contemporary American movie, you'll be pleased to know. So the first one I watched was Becoming Astrid, which is a wonderful Swedish film. It's about Astrid Lundgren, the famous writer who penned the classic children's book, Pippi Longstocking. Mm-hmm. And Alba August, who won't mean anything to most of us, but she is inspirational, playing the rebellious Astrid, who lives a hard but pretty happy life living on a large farm in rural Sweden. The family are religious and strict, but quite caring. Astrid is eager, however, to break free from the confines of her conservative upbringing and accepts an internship at a local newspaper, where she attracts the attention of the married editor, Blomberg, who's played by Henrik Rafalsson. After she gets pregnant, and she's quite young when she gets pregnant by this guy, she's forced to leave her childhood home and goes to Copenhagen on her own, where she secretly gives birth to a son, Lasse. She has to leave him in the care of a wonderful foster mother, Marie, and then she travels to Stockholm to find work as a copywriter. Her family don't want to have anything to do with her at this point. She refuses Blomberg's offer of marriage and uses all of her paltry salary to visit Lasse. When Marie falls ill, Astrid is finally forced to connect with him, her son, and take care of him herself for the first time. And now they have this language disconnect because he's been raised in Copenhagen, she's been in Stockholm, so she has to use her imagination to make a connection and bond with this child. And this is when her flair for storytelling really comes forward. And this bridges the language and the emotional barriers that they have between them. So the triumph of her own life, sort of getting over these quite big obstacles early on, and finding courage to do so, she manages to kind of put all that into her work. And at the end of the film, she's got this great pile of letters from children, real letters, who are all very, very affected and impressed and wowed by her work. So I thought it was touching, credible, unsugar-coated view of life and of how really the human spirit can prevail against adversity. So recommended. So, Mike, you've been at the opposite end of the fantasy spectrum, I think, in Hollywood, right?
Yeah, though I had a couple of quick questions about that, too. I like films that, like, where imagination triumphs over one's reality. Mm-hmm. You know, as long as you earn that by the end, it sounds interesting. But where does the character come from? Does it get into where the character of Pippi...
No, it doesn't talk anything about the actual... You mean Pippi Longstocking?
Yeah.
No. She just gets... She's written, apparently, 300 books. She's voluminous writer, very successful. That's just the most well known because it was translated. But they all seem to be finding courage. They're little letters from children saying, I didn't know I was capable of doing this till you showed me how to be strong and courageous.
Okay.
So I presume they're all, you know, little prince kind of stories where you can do your thing.
Okay. So like more of a character of the fantastic, so to speak.
Mm.
Yeah, interesting.
Beautiful film.
Good. Well, I was hesitating for a while because I know that one of the hottest shows on Netflix now is called Hollywood. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I'm always ambivalent about those things because you worry about revisionist history and, you know, how are they going to make what was interesting back then applicable to where we are now and that kind of mm-hmm. thing. So I was a little slow to start watching the show. But anyway, so I've only so far gotten through one episode. And I'm still ambivalent about it, but it is really interesting. Basically, what I get from the show so far is that it's about two men, one black, one white, which of course very important in the period it's set, which is post-war Hollywood. And the white character, Jack, is a returning vet who's struggling to support his impending family. He takes a job at a service station, a very high-end service station, which is a front for a prostitution ring. Yeah, so
servicing the rich.
Yes, exactly. So it's one of those rather flagrant dark side of Hollywood kind of stories, which of course is endlessly fascinating. So it's an interesting plot so far. I imagine it's going to go a lot of other places. I have six more episodes to go. But the funny thing is that it has this weird subplot with the main character of Jack. He basically kidnaps Archie, who is the black character, who is a struggling writer in Hollywood and can't get a job or at least a screen credit simply because he's black. He kidnaps Archie, forces him, well, somewhat benignly forces him into this prostitution ring. And so they're both entangled in this, you know, again, kind of dark aspect of Hollywood culture at the time. So it takes some weird twists and turns, and you're supposed to just kind of roll with it, which is a little strange. So that's what's happening plot-wise, which is usually secondary to me. I'm much more of a set design person and, you know, what they call mise-en-scène, to be pretentious about it, right? That it's the set design is extraordinarily lavish. There is an attention to detail that is really like Mad Men, but at the next level.
I saw it was like Gatsby. I mean, it was very...
Yeah, it's pitch perfectly beautiful, which of course then you worry about such thing like the plot being subsumed by that. I mean, an emphasis on formalism like that can work both ways. It can be the thing that carries the show, but it can also be something that is consistently distracting.
I was just going to say distracting.
Yeah, yeah. And again, the show, I have to be a little cautious watching it, you know, I can't watch it without being critical, because it kind of plays a little loosely with fact and fiction. It interweaves like bit players, like Cole Porter shows up to have a tryst with one of the characters and that kind of thing. And so I would say that the set design is really beautiful. It's extraordinary, the way it's put together. But it seems as if this emphasis on formalism is almost, it feels, having only seen one episode, it feels like it's compensating in some way. So it kind of leans on sensationalism. So it tries to, how can I put this? Like the extreme visual design is, they're attempting to marry that to a kind of extreme dramatic punches. And if you watch the series, there are a number of little moments where it feels overly dramatic or overly sensational. Never mind the subject matter. And the ending, while it ends on a huge cliffhanger, it seems like too much of a cliffhanger, you know. So it feels, just with the first episode, that they're still trying to find a tone and they're trying to find a balance with that, which is a little bothersome. And there's also a kind of breezy cynicism to the show that bothers me as well, you know. I think by now most people know that the studio system back in the day was corrupt and misogynistic, and, you know, there are all these issues. And so it seems like it's retreading ground that it doesn't need to go over again and again.
Well, it seems like they've kind of injected the Weinberg ingredient into the equation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, again, so it would be a hot topic, because that's something that people are thinking about. You know, it's on everyone's mind.
How long ago that was kicking around.
Yeah, exactly. Right? So well, as I say, having only seen one episode, it's a reserved recommendation from me.
Okay, so my second foreign flick this week took a little more effort to get into, but actually it proved worthwhile in the end. No pun intended, because it's called The Art of Loving. Uh-huh. It's a Polish film based on the biography displaying the work and antics of famous gynecologist and sexologist Michalina Wyszloka. And that is the only Polish name I'm going to say, because they're all enormous, 26 letters long, all the people.
I'm still hung up on famous gynecologist. Could you go a little more in depth on that?
It is both a tale of her life and also the taboo topic of Polish sexuality. Mm-hmm. It is superbly acted and even humorous at times, darkly humorous sometimes, but it's above all human and very relatable. The director is Maria Sadowski, and she's spectacular, because this is not porn and it isn't spectacle. Somehow she treads this incredible line.
Like pornsicle or something? That'd be a word for it. Portmanteau.
You'll make one, I'm sure, Mike. Anyway, she chooses to talk about sex in a kind of unwrapped fashion, without exaggeration, no awkward blushing, no judgment. Mm-hmm. So even when the character's conduct is somewhat questionable and their choice is bizarre, she doesn't moralize about it. She just says it's neither good nor bad, it just is. It's part of everyday life. Mm-hmm. And her book actually subsequently became a Bible. It finally got published in the 70s. So this starts, it's all under the communist regime, and it's all pretty heavy, the beginning of the film, and quite rough to watch, a bit violent. But despite all that, it finally gets published in the 70s and sold 7 million copies. So it pretty much deals with the unabashed story of a very strong woman who sees her body and soul as indivisible, and her mission in kind of making women understand that they can enjoy sex and how to go about it is unwavering. It's her mission. And it's quite funny because at the end she's lecturing to a group of young students, and they said, well, how much of you is in the book? I mean, did you have a lot of lovers? And, you know, they're very interested. She said, well, let us just say a blind man doesn't speak very well about color. That's all she said.
Right.
So anyway, so good opening to you, Mike. You saw Under the Skin. Is that right? Yeah.
Well, again, I want to follow up on that just a quick one.
Yeah.
So what's her name? I don't know the name. Who was it? Are we supposed to know who she was, or is she someone who's there?
Well, I think probably in Polish culture, she's enormous. I mean, this book is a Bible, a sex Bible. Michalina Wyślocka.
Okay.
That's her name. And she, you know.
Spelled like it sounds?
Michalina. And Wyslocka.
Excellent. Thanks.
Yeah. Great film.
That's interesting. So, female sexuality seems to be our inadvertent topic for this episode, because I finally saw Jonathan Glazer's movie from 2013 called Under the Skin, mm-hmm. which is one of those, you know, I'm ashamed to admit I hadn't seen it, and it's been, God, 7 years now, which is crazy. And it's phenomenal. It's absolutely phenomenal. It's a little bit in keeping with the last science fiction film I talked about on our last episode of Moon, but it's actually a little bit better. There's even a bit of a David Bowie connection, which I'll reference, and you can correct my pronunciation there if you need to. Anyway, so Scarlett Johansson stars in it, and I have to say she's, yeah, it's like I went for a while, maybe because she did so many Hollywood movies that I just kind of like stopped remembering how much I'm in love with her, but she's really extraordinary. Anyway, so she plays a character who, from little we can tell, is an alien. We don't know where she's sent from. We don't know exactly why she's on the mission she's on. So it's relatively speaking, a fairly minimal plot. She basically plays an alien life force who takes on the guise of a young woman in Scotland. And the vast majority of the film is basically her as an alien seductress who seduces men back to her lair, which is this seemingly just crummy little apartment.
Her lair?
Her lair, L-A-I.
Her lair.
Yeah, her lair, yeah. So she seduces these men, brings them back to her apartment, but the interior, how do I explain this without drawing pictures? The interior of the apartment is actually this liquid abyss. So these men walk in, and of course they're completely under her spell, and there's that, it's funny because the movie plays with that old Hollywood cliche of how do you know when two characters are going to bed together? You show the clothing on the floor, right? So they play with that a lot. So she seduces these men, and then these men disappear into some kind of like alternate dimension within this liquid abyss. It all sounds really kooky, but it's very well done. It's extraordinarily well paced. It really draws you in. It's a kind of a slow burn, slow reveal kind of movie, which sometimes can be annoying, but it's, for the most part, it's really good. Again, it's an elliptical narrative. It doesn't explain a lot, so you have to do a lot of active processing of what you're watching and put a lot of the pieces together. If I'm in the mood for it, I love movies like that. Because again, we don't really understand her motivation. She seems to be working for someone else. This man keeps following her and disposing of bodies and things. So this is weird subplot. So very little is explained. So it what it's reminiscent of, if you know the movies of Michelangelo Antonioni, if you've seen La Ventura or Red Desert, those great kind of existential Italian angst movies. And I was even thinking about this because Scarlett Johansson reminds me of Monica Vitti, which is a name hopefully more people are familiar with than probably are. But so that's kind of what I kept thinking when I was watching the film. And it would make a perfect companion piece to likewise another kind of puzzle science fiction movie, which is The Men Who Fell to Earth.
Oh, yeah.
The famous Nicholas Rogue movie with David Bowie that confounds me no matter how many times I watch it. But again, what's interesting, and I'll finish with this one point, is that like in that movie, she comes to Earth as an alien. She has a mission, but she becomes gradually seduced by consumer culture, seduced by this increasing sense of humanity. And so, you know, you can imagine it doesn't necessarily end positively, but she does attain a certain kind of consciousness in an alien form, which again, it's
really interesting at this kind of time talking about that, because it's a real topic, how far you go with humanizing artificial intelligence. And I think it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, absolutely that, which again has that inverse effect of where we end up questioning our own consciousness, right? I hate to sound like a broken record, but of course we're still in lockdown. It's a severe word for it, but whatever, you know. So I've been attracted to these alienation movies. You know, I just can't seem to get enough of it. I'm not going for the Contagion movies, so I don't care about that, but just alienation as a physical or as a philosophical concept is important to me, you know? Yeah. And again, and it's also good just to catch up on these movies that have been in my closet, so to speak, for so long that I've never gotten around to.
That's definitely one I'll try and see, because I just think she's gotten better and better. I think she's remarkable.
If you don't mind, did you ever have adventures in Scotland? Because the way they shoot the landscape, it's always a little rainy, if not dreary, and it's austere. I wouldn't normally think of Scotland that way. A lot of it is set in Glasgow, so.
And misty, and, you know, that's why they drink so much up there. Yeah. Well, all these places, where there's nothing else to do but watch the rain.
Yep, it's a very moist landscape, that's my impression. And characters comment on it throughout the film, too. It's, you know, it's a constant reference point, yeah.
Well, I don't know where the British would be without the weather. I mean, it's definitely the backdrop to every day.
Yeah, I just love atmosphere that adds to that, you know. Again, that's...
Well, I think it's ethereal. Scotland is definitely ethereal. Ireland is ethereal. And it lends itself to all sorts of storytelling.
Yep. Well, there's nothing like dystopian science fiction that makes you want to visit a place where it's set. Which is me. I can't wait to get to Scotland now.
Well, many people would say Glasgow is indeed full of aliens.
Oh, yeah, okay. Oh, and can I say too, I can go on and on about this, but again, the way the film deals with language, you know, 10 minutes in, well, there's no dialogue for the first 15 minutes, but even when characters start talking, it's in that thick accent. So I'm like, I'm just going to stop trying to understand what people are saying. It doesn't really seem to matter. And, you know, again, it's one of those movies that where it doesn't. It's much more about atmosphere.
Does Scarlett Johansson have a Scottish accent?
She sounds like she has a British accent. But, you know, again, you're sitting there. Because, again, well, the way she's presented in the film is, you know, she's in this world, but she presents herself in a sense as an outsider.
Not of this world, yeah. So
yeah, she certainly doesn't have the brogue by any stretch. And I don't think that's just poor acting on her part. It's she wants to appear like a foreigner entering into this world where she can seduce men as a stranger, you know. You know, like everyday stuff.
All right, so I did watch a modern contemporary flick this week in English.
Yeah.
And it was a real delight. You know, I find a lot of the stuff I'm milling through on Netflix to be somewhat of a predictable menu, should we say. Mm-hmm. And that's not castigating them, because there's a lot of material on there. But Carrie Philby just leapt out at me and I loved it. So Susan Johnson is the director. It's her debut. And it's a kind of coming-of-age romance that somehow manages to avoid all the cliches, the usual pothole cliches.
Yep.
And Carrie is played by this brilliant actress called Belle Powley. I think you may know her from Diary of a Teenager. Mm-hmm. She was in before. Okay. She's British. She plays this very emotionally stunted 19-year-old prodigy who's already gone to Harvard when she was 15 and who's still... overthinks everything. Very big on intelligence, very little on experience. It's an interesting combination. And great performances, not just by her, but Nathan Lane plays her well-intentioned therapist. He's wonderful.
That's good.
And Gabriel Byrne, who I haven't seen for a long time and I love, plays her very detached father, who's just, you know, well-intentioned but inept. So it's funny, it's refreshing because it isn't predictable. It doesn't really fall into the usual, you know, Hollywood ending. There are a couple of moments where you think, well, how did that happen? But generally not. Mm-hmm. And I think that was the appeal for me. This was typically, you know, young person marooned in New York, trying to do the right thing, not really a lot of people's skills. So trying to navigate life with no compass. And then she also has this love interest played by a young actor called William Moseley, and he's also very good. So I would say more, please. Definitely check it out. Good film.
Excellent.
So, Mike, Midnight Gospel.
Oh, Midnight Gospel. This is the most out of left field thing I think we've yet to talk about, so bear with me. So plot synopsis. First of all, it's an animated show. It's co-created by Pendleton Ward, who created the TV show Adventure Time, which Adventure Time is, relatively speaking, it's like a safe all ages kind of show. And so Midnight Gospel, which is, as far as I understand, his first major follow-up to that, is again like a very kind of crazy anything goes animated show in keeping with Adventure Time, but it's very much for adults. It's crazy stream of consciousness stuff. So quickly, if I can summarize this, I know my plot summaries tend to be tortured. This one might even be worse than usual. Yeah, I know, exactly. All right, so the show centers around a young kind of slacker type guy who is a, quote, simulation farmer, okay? His name is Clancy Gilroy. So he's this kind of doofus, like loser character. And what he does is he travels to various simulated planets. The first episode, he visits one of the Earths. There are many, many Earths in the show. Another episode, he visits an ice cream planet. Another episode, he visits the clown planet, etc. So they're these weirdly themed planets. And what he does, he visits them through virtual simulation. He meets a random bizarre character, interviews that character, and then takes the interview back home with him. He kind of gets out of the simulated matrix state and basically uses the interview as an episode for broadcast on his video stream. And the video stream is called The Midnight Gospel. Okay. So there's the plot. How much of that do you need me to unpack?
It's challenging. And it's easy, that's accessible, all that very.
Yeah, well, it's like Futurama or these other shows, which when you first watch it, you're like this, or Rick and Morty, it's like, this is insane. What is this show? And then after a couple of episodes, you get into the flow of the repeating patterns of each episode. You know, it's designed in a very formulaic way. So each episode is the same. He goes into the simulated space, visits the planet, interviews someone, comes back.
So and it's animated.
It's, yeah, well, this is really what I think is much more significant in terms of it being a recommendation for me. I don't know if you know what my favorite movie of all time is. Have I ever told you?
You probably have, Michael. I'm sorry, I've forgotten.
Well, that's fine. It's Yellow Submarine.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, okay, yeah. So it's almost like a too easy guess or something. But anyway, so the way I would describe Midnight Gospel is like Yellow Submarine, but a hyperactive Yellow Submarine. Like if you took that movie and fast-forwarded through it, that's very much what Midnight Gospel is like. And that's, for me, that's like the highest possible praise as far as animation and design is concerned, because the show is insane. Like every image is so extraordinarily well realized and well designed. And you're just going through these phantasmagoric spaces one after the other. And what's likewise, and it's also very apocalyptic. Like each episode is set on a planet that is in some state of war or chaos or, you know, absurdity or insanity. And so the main character, Clancy, just kind of travels nonchalantly through these worlds and has these crazy, elaborate philosophical conversations with these random people he meets to interview. So you have this insanity happening all around the characters, like these end of the world scenes, while at the same time, you have these two characters who are just having this kind of in-depth and yet casual conversation about drugs or about Buddhism or about celebratory magic like Aleister Crowley stuff, it's really heady. I mean, you know, back in the 60s, right? Something like Yellow Submarine, they would say it's a head film. Well, this is very much like a head film. Yeah, it feels like you're on some kind of hallucinogen as you're watching it. It's really that effective. I get excited kind of just talking about it.
So a couple of questions. Just one, it's an unfortunate title, I think, because I just don't get why they called it that. But the other thing is, what is the purpose of this guy going to these different planets? I mean, is it for his own individual blogging?
That's it. I mean, that's, yeah, he's a vlogger. And he makes a career out of it. I mean, he, for what it's worth, you know, he's kind of a slacker, loser type of character. But for what it's worth, he makes what seems to be a living at going to the farthest reaches of the simulated universes, acquiring, programming, novel, you know, exotic or novel programming, and bringing it back.
So he's the window on the world for people. He's bringing back these things from the galaxies.
Yes, exactly. Like he's, it's every episode is a quest. It's similar to, Adventure Time was similar to that, but this is far more extreme. If I had to, likewise, maybe compare to something else, if anyone has ever seen the old Ralph Bakshi movies, there was like Fritz the Cat is his most famous one. So they're violent and extreme and crass in a Bakshi way. But it's also beautifully, eloquently designed. I mean, it's just the show has such a rich texture to it that you can just sit and watch it on mute and just, you know, it's eye candy from start to finish. It's absolutely amazing. Yeah. It might wear down on your nervous system if you try to binge it, but maybe one episode at a time I would recommend.
So this isolation thing really is starting to show on you, Mike.
It is, yeah. I can't even disguise it anymore. I've been working on that so hard too.
Well, listen, before we say cheerio for this week, just a couple of things. Don't miss the great documentaries that are out there on PBS. I don't know, some people don't watch a lot of PBS, but there are four different documentary strands. They're all just brilliant. One is Points of View. Last week I saw a great program, I think it was called The Apology, about three women that were comfort women to the Japanese. Their lives, harrowing, but riveting, you know, their story. Mm-hmm. So that was one. And the other one was equally amazing. And it was called Prison Songs. And it went to an Aboriginal prison in Western Australia. And it was really a very insightful view of the life of the inmates. And each of them made different kinds of music out of their life. I don't know how much of that was orchestrated by the producer or how much of it was actually, these people are talented, let's just see what they get up to. But it was very well done. It didn't feel contrived.
But sense of doubt that you have as you're watching it, that's not distracting, is it? I mean, you know.
Not at all. No, it's so harrowing. The nature of these people's lives is just so horrific that it's a kind of welcome relief that some of them have been able to rap about it. Other people do these very soulful, gospel-y songs that they've written about their lives. They're really, I thought it was a very clever vehicle.
Interesting. You know, what were the titles of those again?
Prison Songs. Mm-hmm. And the other one, I think, was The Apology.
Okay. And they're like one-off documentaries, or are they part of a series?
One-off. Yeah. POV is Points of View, so it's one-off director's takes.
Of course.
The other one is the Global Looks, which is under World Channel. So it's good. So that's our rich store of options for you this week from the, as Michael would say, the candy store of the mind.
I was going to say, is it just me or is it like being home this much? It's beginning to dawn on me how much is available to watch. Have you noticed that?
Oh dear. I'm not going to admit to that at all. No.
Okay, good. Neither am I. I'm going to get out and work in the garden.
That's right. Do something healthy. Okay. On that note, stay viewing, and we'll see you soon.
It's healthy. Take care.
Bye.
Bye from Michael Dow.
Bye from Mary Stack.